It's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teaching, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Today is the last talk in the series, the final boundary of you making your own personal vow, which I hope has been fulfilling and successful for you. Registration for the next series will open on July 31st, and you'll receive everything you need for that beforehand. And there'll be a week to register for the next series on that will feature Dogen's Japanese Waka. And that will begin on Sunday, August 7th. I'm very much looking forward to it. So this is a good time, Sahar, to show Katagiri's photograph. Yeah, it's a terrific photograph of him. Just so you see who we're talking about. He's very firm and upright. The Minnesota Zen Center, where Katagiri Roshi served as abbot until his death in 1990, at the age of 63. It's located on the eastern shore of Lake Calhoun in South Minneapolis. The center was named, this is an interesting name, K-O-U-N, Kounzan Ganshoji by Katagiri. And the mountain name Zan means mountain, Kone, means cultivating the clouds and is taken from one of Dogen's poems. But what I just learned last night is that Koun, K-O-U-N, is the first name of Koun Eijo, who is Dogen's most dear and beloved and long-term disciple. Eijo started with him in the very beginning, right after he came back from Japan. The very first monastery he formed, Eijo was a part of that. That was maybe 5 years or so after he got back. And I'll tell you later, another day, about Eijo's. He became Dogen's assistant, and he was so passionate about it that even after he died, he felt like he wanted to continue being Dogen's assistant. And it was just a very touching story of Eijo's commitment and full-on service to Dogen. And the idea that his first name comes up in this poem, it comes up here with Katagiri Roshi and is taken from one of Dogen's poems. I'm sure that Dogen was thinking of Eijo, Koun Eijo, when he used that word in his poem. Anyway, the temple name Gansho, so Ji means temple, so Ganshoji means Gansho temple, and Gansho means living by vow. And or as Okumura Roshi translates it even more beautifully, temple born of vow. Temple born of vow, I just love that. Which it alludes to one of the definitions of a bodhisattva. We've mentioned this before. Ordinary people are those who live being pulled by karma, whereas bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. So it's a very different situation. Katagiri often spoke about living by vow. And in one of his books, Each Moment is the Universe, he said that the wholehearted practice of Zazen in itself is living by vow. The wholehearted practice of Zazen in itself is living by vow. And Okamura Roshi, referring to the Minneapolis Meditation Zen Center, after Katagiri's death, this is what he says. After I became head teacher there, I used his office, and in it was a cabinet holding his writings. Since I wanted to understand his goals, attitude, and teaching, I read much of his work. Okamura Roshi was the abbot of Katagiri's temple for 3 years after Katagiri's death. So he's saying he went into the office and he read, he found this poem that he thought was very wonderful, and he read it, and he also read it in Japanese. So I think you've heard this poem before, but today, Okamura Roshi has explicated it very beautifully around the Four Noble Truths. And that's basically what I want to talk about today, this amazing explication of Katagiri Roshi's very personal poem around the Four Noble Truths. So the poem is called Peaceful Life. Being told that it's impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it is possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. But whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. Being asked, what is unfitting? I don't know what it is, but my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know what a mystery human is. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. From my human eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become a Buddha, but this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells me, yes, I will. Just practice right here now and achieve continuity endlessly forever. This is living in vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. I know I've read passages of this to you before. But it's such an impressive statement. And then Okamura Roshi continues. This is a poem about vow. And I also found his original poem in Japanese. When I read it closely, I saw that it is a lucid explanation of the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths, by the way, just in case you've forgotten, the first noble truth is that life is suffering, because not everybody understands that. Life is suffering. And the second noble truth is that there's a cause for this suffering. And the third noble truth is there's a way out of this suffering. And the fourth noble truth is here's the way out of this suffering. And then he lays out the Eightfold Noble Path. And this teaching of the Four Noble Truths was done by Shakyamuni Buddha in the beginning. It was the first teaching he taught, all the way through his 40 years of teaching. And on his deathbed, he gave the teaching of the Four Noble Truths yet again to someone who demanded to be seen by him. And Shakyamuni told his assistant, Ananda, please let him see me. And then he taught the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths are incredibly central to Zen Buddhism. That's all there is to it, to all of Buddhism. And so this poem that we're going to hear about in its four verses separately, Okumura Roshi feels are a lucid explanation of the Four Noble Truths. So then he continues, and this is about the first truth, the first stanza, which is about the first truth, the first noble truth of the truth of suffering. Quote, one believes in despair, one believes in excitement, whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. And this is Okumura Roshi. This is the reality of our lives. In Japanese, the phrases he used for possible and impossible can also be translated as good and not good. We encounter many such judgments in our life. Sometimes people say you are good, sometimes not good. Each time we are judged, we feel despair or excitement. And we lived based on opinions, not just other people's, but our own. When we're successful, we think this is great. When we've had a hard time, we feel small. We may even feel life isn't even worth living. And this up and down is samsara, the reality of our life that is described as transmigration through the six realms. And you've probably forgotten, because I used to forget all the time, but the six realms that we can constantly transmigrate through, and then it is said that after death, we go to one of them, supposedly, that's the legend. But anyway, they're important because we're in them all the time. You know, like every day, we could transmigrate through all six. And the six are heaven, and right below that, fighting gods, and then human, and then animals, hungry ghosts, and hell. And so just, you can be a human for a while, and then you go to the heavenly realm for a while, and then you're hell right after that, and hungry ghosts, you can't ever get satisfied. These are all aspects, sort of metaphysical aspects of our daily life. So Katagiri emphasizes again, this is our life as human beings. We always feel somewhat unsatisfied. Whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. Happy or sad, there is some dissatisfaction. We can't find a peaceful, steady, absolute foundation for our life. Something is lacking. Even in the heavenly realms, and then the hell realm, of course. So we start to question, what's wrong? What's the problem? What causes this feeling of emptiness? And so here we come to the second noble truth, the causes. And we want to understand this feeling. And in the second stanza, Katagiri says, being asked what is unfitting, I don't know what it is, but my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know. We want to know the real cause of the problem. This is unique to human beings. Okumura is explaining, we alone ask who we are and how we should live. Other animals don't have this problem. And Roshi continues, Dogen Zenji said that to study the Buddha way is to study the self. And I think a human is a being that has to study the self. Other living things don't have to do this. They don't even have questions. But for us, this self is a big question. We humans are troublesome, mysterious creatures. And we need to understand this mystery and this questioning is the need to understand. It's our Bodhi mind, a mind that awakens to the reality of our life. And Katagiri says, as to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. And so this is the third noble truth. Okamura Roshi comments, the Buddha understood or clarified this mystery. He saw the answer to the questions, what are human beings? What is the cause of human suffering? And he awakened and understood how we can live in a wholesome way with peace. So this is this is approaching the fourth noble truth. The reality that the Buddha found in his enlightenment is interdependent origination. That was his big, this interdependent co-arising that we talk about all the time. That was Shakyamuni's discovery in his enlightenment. Katagiri's phrase, knowing how to walk with people, refers to this interdependence. It means that we can't live without other people and things. For Buddhists, studying the self means studying how to walk with others. That's why the Buddha emphasized the importance of Sangha, a place where we can live and practice together. Katagiri's comment in the last stanza, from my human eyes, I feel it is really impossible to become a Buddha. It reminds us that even though we study the Buddha's teachings, we are still human. And the Buddha's achievement is so great that it's almost impossible for us humans to follow his way. But even so, one vows to practice. And in the Japanese version, the word for vow is N-E-G-A-U is the transliteration, negao, which means to wish. And this is really interesting what Okamura has done with this. We wish to practice and aspire to become Buddhas. Katagiri uses the word aspire as the translation for inori. This is another word. Inori is usually translated as prayer, but here it means deeply wishing for something that doesn't seem possible. Even though we know that it's impossible to follow the Buddha's way, we deeply wish to make it possible. Then Katagiri says he vows to be resolute. Here, the Japanese version is this word keishin, which means to make up one's mind, to be fixed and determined. Next, he says he tells himself, yes, I will. And even though he feels it's impossible, he can't help but say this. And that vow, I think this is maybe the most important point, that vow comes from the deepest part of the self. Intellectually, it seems impossible, but from our deep life force, we can't help but say yes. Yes, I will. That's the vow. Yes, I will. A vow should not be made by our intellect or our emotional impulse. It should come from the deepest part of ourselves. And those of you who haven't been able to make your personal vow may not have gone deep enough because it is there. But you have to get very quiet and very much like in a Zazen state, and it will reveal itself to you. So just practice right here now means that we start practicing immediately. We can't postpone it because the wish is so deep. Somehow we have to start searching for our own self. There's no time to wait. And achieve continuity means to practice continuously. Because it's impossible to achieve what Buddha did, we have to practice forever. There's no end, no goal, and yet we make small steps one by one, moment by moment. We try to walk along the Buddha's way one step, or just a half a step in all situations. Sometimes we're happy because we feel we're good practitioners and doing the right thing. And sometimes sitting in this posture every morning is boring or painful, and yet we do it. In any situation, we try to adopt the attitude Katagiri describes, the attitude being told that it's impossible, one believes in despair, is that so? Being told that it's possible, one believes in excitement, that's right. But even in our practice, we need to work with this attitude of up and down. Sometimes sitting in our zazen, we feel great. We feel that we are enlightened. Sometimes we feel we are in hell. In either situation, we just go through it endlessly forever. Katagiri Roshi said, this is living by vow. No, he said, this is living in vow. In vow. It means to sit, to try to help others, to live and work with others each day of our lives. When we are living in vow, in our emotion, in our human sentiment, there are good times and hard times. Like all people in samsara, we are still in the six realms that I just mentioned. And yet, we can't find a peaceful basis, a foundation for our life, which is never moved, but we can't find a foundation that's not moved by our human sentiment, which is our zazen. That is not moved by our human sentiment. And that is vow. That's the reality of our life. That is finally the reality of our life, actually. So the last line of the poem, herein one's peaceful life is found. Okamura Roshi says, when we vow, we feel we have a duty. And usually taking a vow is like making a promise. And if we don't keep it, we feel bad or fear that we might be punished. But vow in Buddhism is not like that. It's not something we do with our intellect, our shallow emotion. We vow toward the Buddha, toward something absolute and infinite. And as a bodhisattva, we can never say, I have achieved all vow. We cannot be proud of our achievements because in comparison with the infinite, anything we achieve is insignificant. Each of us has different capabilities, of course. And if we can't do very much, then we practice just a little. There's no reason for us to feel small or say we're sorry. We just try to be right here with this body and mind and move forward one step, or just half a step. And this is our practice in a concrete sense. And I know for myself, when I get up from zazen, my first instinct is to think, ugh, you know, oh my gosh. But then I say, no judging zazen. And that's all, no judging zazen. And then I stop. And I hope to pass it on to all of you. When you do zazen, actually you don't do zazen. Zazen does zazen. So don't judge it. You're not allowed. It's not yours to judge. So this isn't your ballpark. It's zazen's ballpark. So don't find yourself saying, well, that was nothing. All I did was think. You set zazen to the best of your ability, and then it's over and you're done, and you don't judge it. And you tell yourself, no judging zazen. So I'm giving you permission, no judging zazen. But back into this, the distinction between living in vow or living by vow. So Katagiri Roshi used the expression living in vow because it sounds natural in English. By vow, perhaps is because D.T. Suzuki had this expression in his book, Living by Zen, Living by Zen. In the Japanese translation of this book, he says something like, living beings are living in Zen, but only human beings can live by Zen. Saying that all living beings, dogs, cats, plants, flowers, are living in Zen doesn't mean they abide in meditation or samadhi, but rather that they're living in the reality of life as it is. And everything lives in the reality of life in Zen, but only human beings have to make a conscious effort to do so. As D.T. Suzuki says, only human beings do this, but that doesn't mean that we're superior to other beings. Because of our doubts and delusions, we have to constantly return to reality and make an effort to live on that basis. And that, according to D.T. Suzuki, is living by Zen. A life led by vow is a life animated or inspired by vow, not one watched or scolded or consoled by vow. These verbs create a separation between the person and the vow. The simple phrase, living by vow, emphasizes that the person and the vow are one. Our life is itself a vow. Our life is itself a vow. I like, after just saying some words, to point out some of the most important points, because I think that it just all comes at you at once, and it's hard to settle on what might be some takeaways from what you just heard. So that's why I give you some, at least for starters. So here are five takeaways from what I just said. The first one is the temple name Ganjo means living by vow or temple born of vow. Temple born of vow, and alludes to one of the definitions of a bodhisattva. Ordinary people are those who live being pulled by the karma. Bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. It's so, so different. And it's not like bodhisattvas don't also have karma, but they have a way to organize their lives. In an uplifting way and a really useful and dedicated way. The second point, the second important takeaway is Katagiri Roshi's idea of the wholehearted practice of Zazen is itself living by vow. The wholehearted practice of Zazen is itself living by vow. So that isn't just kind of begrudgingly doing your 10 minutes or something, but it's with your whole heart. And it doesn't matter how long, actually, but it's with your whole heart, not begrudgingly. That's the difference. And the third point, the reality that the Buddha found in his enlightenment is interdependent origination. That was the Big Bang, our life actually is interdependently co-arising with all other beings. Katagiri's phrase, knowing how to walk with people, refers to this interdependence. It means that we can't live without other people and things. For Buddhists, studying the self means studying how to walk with others. That's why the Buddha emphasized the importance of Sangha, a place where people live and practice together. And I think it's this point is increasingly apparent with not only the pandemic, but the war in the Ukraine and the shortage of many things that we take for granted. I think we can appreciate more and more how interdependent we are. And the fourth point, a vow should not be made by our intellect or an emotional impulse. It should come from the deepest part of ourselves. And I remember when I made my personal vow, I told myself I wouldn't get out of bed until I knew what I wanted my life to be, or actually what I knew who I already was, so that I can manifest that. And it just came as a little, I mean, I was several days, doing literally just being quiet there. And finally, this teeny little voice. So it's not like it's going to come screaming at you. You really have to get very quiet. And then the fifth point to take away, a life led by vow is a life animated or inspired by vow, not one that is watched, scolded, or consoled by vow. These verbs create a separation between the person and the vow. The simple phrase living by vow emphasizes that the person and the vow are one. Our life is itself a vow. And I think there's a difference between those of us who can see that our life is itself a vow and others who never even heard the word vow or couldn't care less. And then I also like to give you some ideas to think about during the week so that you can deepen your listening on Sunday. You can deepen it through the week. And so here are five ideas. And the first is about this feeling somewhat unsatisfied. And whichever is chosen, it doesn't fit our heart neatly. Katagiri felt this very strongly, and he talked about it a lot. And I wonder, one thing to think about is, do you feel that? What is your impression? And have you experienced what he means when he says that no matter how happy we are, there's still a little pebble of dissatisfaction in there, no matter how happy we are? And to look at yourself in a moment of, you're just thrilled with something that's happened, and see if there isn't that little pebble of dissatisfaction anyway. It's very interesting to study that. And the second idea for reflection during the week is this idea: the wholehearted practice of Zazen is itself living by vow. And this sounds very poetic, but can you articulate how it works? How is that the wholehearted practice of Zazen is living by vow? So unless you've made the wholehearted practice of Zazen your personal vow, unless you've made that, that your life in itself is a vow, is living by vow, could you articulate how that works, how that's so that you don't just buy it? It is a truth, but how? Okay, and the third one: a vow should not be made by our intellect or an emotional impulse. It should come from the deepest part of us. And so that's just, again, that's a hint for you who still haven't, those of you who still haven't finished your personal vow. I've said this before today, you're not there yet. Don't think that you don't have one though. Let your vow make your vow. Let your vow make itself come into its own. But to do that, you have to be very silent. So allow your vow to shape itself in your Zazen. And then the fourth point, because it's impossible to achieve what the Buddha did, we have to practice forever. Some find this soothing, like you don't have to think about it ever. So now that's settled, I don't have to worry about that anymore. But where do you stand with regard to this truth? How does that affect, what do you think of that? That you have to practice this forever. I think I might have said this before, but I remember having the thought that it should be that when you walk in the door to the Zendo the very first time, someone should warn you, do you realize that this is a trap? Once you start, you won't be able to stop, and it's not that easy. We should be warned about this right in the beginning, I think. So, the fifth one, just practice right here, right now, means that we start practicing immediately. We can't postpone it because the wish is so deep, even if you're not aware of it. Somehow we have to start searching for our own self, and there's no time to waste. And are you in touch with there is no time to wait or waste? Are you in touch with that part? You have to start right now. And describe, if you can, describe what this feeling feels like and what pacifies it. It's a kind of urgent feeling. And what pacifies that urgent feeling for you? First of all, do you have it? And second of all, if you do, what pacifies it? And sometimes we don't know that there's a problem until we find something that pacifies it. And then we go, oh, I didn't even know that was a problem. And so I'm asking you if you can pinpoint what pacifies this urgency to know yourself, to study yourself. Dogen says we have to do that. And he says that that's what Zen Buddhism is. That Zen Buddhism is to study the self. I deliberately made the talk a little short today to allow as much time as possible for questions, since this is our last talk in the series. So I wonder if there are any questions.
Thank you, Gail. There is a first question that we have. Why is choosing a specific vow important? Isn't following the path, practicing Zazen, and trying to see interdependent origination in everything enough?
It can be if you make it also your personal vow, because we really actually need both. We need this large general understanding of what we're here for and what we're basically doing with our life. And then each of us is unique. We have very individual qualities, personalities, capabilities, special skills. We each have those things. And so we actually can all take the same large overarching vow, but we aren't all cookie cutter people. Human beings are not cookie cutter, you know, like gingerbread men or something. We're not that. And so that's why we have to make an individual personal vow. Now, some people's individual vow is the same as their large grandiose vow, the large overarching vow of their lives. You know, I want to find the reality of life and live in the reality of life as it is. That could be an overarching vow, the way an overarching vow is put. But then in your daily life, what do you do? I mean, how does that translate into, you know, how do you get up in the morning and how do you make your bed and that? So we actually do need both, because we're each so different. And if we don't acknowledge our differences, we'll miss a big part of our incarnation. It's like we'll ignore the things that were given to us as gifts this lifetime. Thank you. That's my understanding. That isn't just my opinion. That's my understanding of the Buddhist tradition to make both a large vow and a personal vow. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Gail. The next question that we have is, the line, this is our life as human beings. We always feel somewhat and unsatisfied. Whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. I have only recently started to be aware of this. Even in the best of moments, I feel slightly agitated. It's a surprise to learn that there is something I can do about it.
you know, Western culture just promotes this kind of rah-rah, jumping up and down feeling. It's an innocent, young, childlike feeling that so delights us in children. But even in a child, there is a force that negates being a child. The child becomes a toddler, the toddler becomes a pre-teenager, a teenager becomes a teenager, and then so forth. And old people have in them a force that negates being an old person, and then they rejoin universal life. And so it's this constant rotation with interdependent origination and co-arising. And so if we try to stay in our childhood modes, clinging and treasuring those expressions to the exclusion of more mature expressions, we will notice something not properly joined. And the more you practice Zazen, the more attuned you'll be to the presence of this unsettled heart, and to the presence also of a different kind of satisfaction. So please continue what you're doing. You will have a deeper and deeper appreciation of it. With perseverance, you will. Thank you.
Gil, the next comment that we have is, a vow should not be made by our intellect or an emotional impulse. It should come from the deepest part of us. I don't really see why I can't just figure out with my mind what would be the best path for me. I feel that my mind is a deep part of me.
Well, it does feel that way, especially in our culture that adores the mind and luxuriously rides on its products. But the truth is that it's the mind that bars us from ultimate truth. It's the mind that gets in the way of our realizing ultimate truth. So one ultimate truth that Dogen emphasized was that things, we do not go to things and bring them toward us, which is a very controlling. We allow things to come to us. So it means everything in the world is a gift. And we've talked about this before. So to allow your ultimate truth your life, the reality of your life, to allow that to come to you as a gift, and trying to think it out is too controlling. You actually miss the heart of it that way. And that said, it doesn't mean that you don't or can't think about your vow. It just means that its wholeness, you need to allow its wholeness to arise in you from a deeper place. Actually, you need to allow your vow to shape itself. I'm going to tell you a story that illustrates this perfectly, I think. I'm reading a memoir of a ballerina named Toni Bentley, who joined the Balanchine community when she was 10 years old. And before that, she was a very fussy eater and she was very skinny. And her mother was worried about her and took her to the doctor. And the doctor said, you should give her more exercise so that she creates in her an appetite. And so her mother, this is in England, and her mother found a ballet studio for young people, and she signed her daughter up for dance lessons, ballet lessons. And so then they moved to America and in New York, and in the apartment building, I think, where they lived, the mother, like in the laundry room or something, was talking to a neighbor and said, "Do you know where I can find a place where I can give my daughter ballet lessons and get some ballet lessons for my daughter?" And the other person said, "Well, here, the School of American Ballet is where a lot of people go." And the mother treks Tony to this school, having no idea that it's like this central school for, you know, the most famous ballerinas in the world. But so there is Tony, and Tony gets accepted. Tony got accepted to the school. And then, but after a few months, her mother was told that they were worried about Tony's feet and that she actually was on probation. And when Tony heard about this, she was mortified. She took her very super expensive ballet slippers, toe shoes. She ran them down the hall to the garbage chute and dumped them in the incinerator. And then at that moment, she realized absolutely that she wanted to dance. She would fight for it. She would let nothing stop her, and she would power through anything to make it happen. Right at the moment that she dumps her shoes down the incinerator, she knows that she has to do this thing. I think it's a great example of how the force of knowing comes to you. The force of knowing comes to you in the most unexpected circumstances. Are the deepest part of ourselves come forward. And she was already a ballerina. I mean, you can't become a Balanchine dancer and not already be a ballerina. And so the ballerina in her said, you know, "Hey, I'm out now. I'm going to be a ballerina." Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. Next one we have is, usually taking a vow is like making a promise. If we don't keep it, we feel bad or fear that we might be punished. But vow in Buddhism is not like that. It's not something we do with our intellect or shallow emotion. We vow toward the Buddha, toward something absolute and infinite. I guess this isn't really a question. So this is a comment that we got.
You know, all we have is what Suzuki Roshi used to call things as it is, just reality as it is. That's all we have. And when you break that down, there's nothing. It's emptiness. It's empty of, we are empty of an individual self that we feel we have. It actually, when you look at it carefully, there's nothing permanent there. So our vow can't be anything has duality about it. It's about the reality of our interconnectedness and the universal life that entangles us with everybody. So our vow and our life are the same, and only our minds have realized this and prefer something for me and me doesn't exist. And so this is a place to make an important distinction between your personal vow and beyond your and what's your personal vow and what's beyond yours. And like Toni being a ballerina, she is a ballerina. So and I didn't write my poetry because I want to write poetry. My poetry wrote my poetry. You could even leave the my out of it. Poetry wrote poetry through me. And that was ever present to me and continually ever present to me. So what I was saying earlier about our thinking mind is what prevents us from seeing ultimate reality. Our thinking mind, which we are so dedicated to and so reliant on, is hindering us from the absolute most important thing. And it's not that we need to give up our minds, but we have to know also the most important thing. And we know it not through our mind. We know it through another avenue. And it's bigger than our mind. And actually, like for Toni to realize that she's a ballerina, that ballerinahood announced itself for her. That's not her mind. That's not her mind. And for poetry to announce itself for me and then organize my life around being able to do that for 40 years, that's not my mind. That's just this other force that absolutely had to express itself because it had a job to do. And then when it finished its job, I could finish, and I did, and so did Toni. I see that I'm almost out of time, and I, for those of you who came late, I want to just say again that registration for the next series will open on July 31st, and you'll have a week to register for the next series that will feature Dogen's Japanese Waka, which is a kind of short poetry. And that will begin on Sunday, August 7th. And I want to thank my team, Brendan and Sahar and Brian, for making these talks possible. I'm so grateful. And I'm so grateful that the electricity situation in Pakistan is amazingly presenting itself to be there on Sunday. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.